Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
That's right. And so we've got some more reality today.
Brother.
We talked about Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien a little while back, and that just wasn't enough for me. So I thought, why not watch 9 hours of movie and talk about that?
What, you piker, you were watching the released version?
Well, how long?
We looked up the extended version, by the way. It's almost 12 hours.
Okay, 12 hours of movie. And with us again for this discussion is Seth. Seth Wilson, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Good, yeah.
So you said this is reality. Are you saying that was reality TV we just watched?
That's right. It was a documentary.
Yes.
Oh, say it ain't so.
You bet. Well, one of the things that I was most interested, the reason why I was interested in talking about this is I think it highlights, you know, I think movies have become like the pinnacle of artistic achievement in our culture. You know, everything is always like, you know, if you read a book, you know, people always say, well, that should be a movie. You know, that just seems to be that's our common experience in our culture. And having read Lord of the Rings so carefully and then having seen the movies as many times as I've had, I've probably seen them, I don't know, 3 or 4 times since getting the extended version over the years.
Me too, probably.
Yeah, you know, I put them on every now and then. I don't always sit and watch the whole thing, you know. Sometimes I just like to watch a battle or something, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And
blame you, really.
Yeah, right. So it's just interesting to look at the decisions that filmmakers make and why they make them, especially in regards to this. I guess the first question we should throw out there is, do you think that the Lord of the Rings movies succeeded, and what's the definition of succeed?
Oh, wait, I was going to ask you the definition of succeed.
I would say that the definition for me of success is that they successfully transmitted the themes of the author. Is that reasonable?
Okay, yeah. Then not fully.
Mm-hmm.
By that definition, I would give the movies a B minus or a C plus.
Yeah,
okay.
I would say
they did an average job.
Okay, yeah. So what they, you know, so they missed the themes according to you guys. You know, what was like some of the major theme that they missed?
Well, because they hit things like if you're small, you can still make a huge difference. That's actually said at some point, you know, to Merry or Pippin or somebody like that. And so they hit some of those big themes like that. They even a couple times mentioned luck or chance, but they didn't really, it wasn't a flowing theme. And to me, I think they missed so many chances to show mercy.
Yeah, they played up the fight with the tension between Sam and Frodo and Gollum, but they didn't highlight the mercy that Frodo showed several times. The scene with at the Forbidden Pool, they really played that up as Frodo tricking Gollum and that providing Gollum some legitimate reason to distrust Frodo. Whereas the book, you know, really Frodo made a concerted effort every step of the way to try to at least convey to Gollum that he was trying to save him.
Yeah, and I think there were times when they changed the story just enough, like the fighting over when Gollum is turning Frodo against Sam, and Sam is not given a chance to show Gollum mercy at the end. He doesn't have to say, oh, okay, I won't kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And then also this whole idea of Frodo continually going, I have to believe he can change, Sam, because then there's hope for me. Well, that's not how it was in the book at all. It all becomes self-interested instead of a concerted effort to say, yeah, I can't stand him either, but he is a living being. And how would it be if we were like him? You lose those subtle things all along the way.
I agree with that 100%. That's one of the most striking differences to me is the character of Frodo. You know, one of the things that didn't even happen in the book was when he, you know, kicked Sam out, basically said, mm-hmm. get out of here, go home. And they separate. Right. That never happened. That. Yeah.
Never.
It doesn't. Yeah.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
I wonder why they did it. You think they just thought it would be cool, or did you think they had a reason?
Some of the changes they made, I understood. Nessie, we got them, watched the extended version when they came out, and then they have been sitting on my shelf this whole time. So, because they take a long time, and it never occurred to me just to go, I want to see the today is not that day speech or whatever, you know, I'd forgotten that even existed. So I was watching it going, oh man, this is great.
Yeah.
So to me, you watch the whole thing or you don't watch it at all, I guess is how I was thinking. So we got done with that last movie and I was like, oh my gosh, how long was that? Tom's like, that was 4 hours. So yeah. So I was surprised by the way they'd moved a lot of things around. Like they moved, I was really stunned when Saruman is killed so early in the story. And yeah, Grimma or however you say his name, he stabs him and he's offered a tiny bit of mercy, but it's this whole, it diminishes everything about that situation. And then... But I could see why they moved it, because they just didn't have room for the scouring of the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
They had to treat all those themes with one tiny little scene of them sitting around the table at the tavern going, wow, not even talking, just going, we do not fit in here anymore. We have all changed. And I actually thought for what they did, that was okay. I mean,
I like that. Yeah. I appreciated that.
They at least addressed it. And then a lot of the other times they didn't, because they changed Arwen completely. I mean, by even showing her so much, played up all those themes. They changed all the themes for Faramir. I weep for the movie Faramir. But I think in those cases, I don't think they understood the importance of the themes that we're lamenting that they're gone.
Well, and it's a question of priority, too. Tolkien, the themes were the most important to him, and then he was faced with, okay, how do I present these in something that's entertaining and will actually sell? But he was coming from a place of trying to express those themes first. Peter Jackson was trying to make an entertaining movie, and if he could get as many of Tolkien's themes in as he could, that's great. And I do believe that Peter Jackson... to some level, genuinely cares about Tolkien's themes and trying to get those across. Whether he completely understands them, I don't know. But I think he did, at least, I mean, there's that whole bit. I've actually listened to a lot of the commentary in the extended
versions.
Not all of it, but he did the gift-giving scene in Lothlorien. He fought to have as much of that included in the theatrical version, and he lost that battle. They said it was too long already. It was the first movie, so he didn't really have a track record yet, and so he didn't win that fight. But he does, to some extent, he does actually care about that. But his goal at the end of the day is to make a movie that will smash box office records and make millions of dollars of revenue.
Well, in a lot of ways, of course, he did that. And in a lot of ways, I think he succeeded amazingly. Like, the look of it in most cases, is so right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, visually. And that's what film does well, anyway.
It's
a visual medium.
But I also felt like it wouldn't have been, and again, I know there are constraints and this and that, but sometimes it would have just taken one line to redeem something or to explain something more, like when Aragorn is healing Arwen after the battle. All it would have taken is one cracked old healer's voice going, "Oh yeah, the old kings could always heal someone. That was the sign of a true king."
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
So there were a lot of missed opportunities, and I know there were. It was a huge project, but I look at the stuff about, especially, I really didn't understand from the movie point of view, I understood the whole playing up of Arwen's role,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that it weakened Aragorn so much, and everything that was done was, don't forget the dark ships. And he's like, "What? What the hell are you talking about?" You know, and everybody else is pushing him to do the right thing. When by that point, even in the movie, he doesn't need that.
Yeah. Yeah, all that self-doubt that he has, particularly early on, is just not there in the books, or not very much. You know, there's that bit in the Council of Elrond where Boromir's kind of taunting him, and it's like, well, if the heir of Elendil is strong enough, and Aragorn's like, well, maybe we'll put it to the test one day. But, you know, for the most part, he's pretty confident throughout.
Yeah.
And as far back as Bree, you know, he kind of stands up and mm-hmm. you know, reveals himself uncloaked. He's like, he knows... Mm-hmm. who he is and wants that.
And that's why I was thinking some of those huge themes where they really kind of, to me, just went way off track. I just feel like it was either that it was sacrificed in order because they'll never understand it, which I think is wrong. Mm-hmm. If it's handled right, they will.
I agree.
Or because they themselves didn't understand that if you kind of break this leg of the stool, the other stuff, the chair itself wobbles too mm-hmm. a lot, you know? I mean, I think Faramir had plenty of daddy issues in the book without having to make him this guy who's standing there crying before he goes into the next battle. Okay, I'll do it for Faramir.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with the statement that, you know, Jackson seemed to care quite a bit. On these extended versions, I watched three half-hour features. One of them, there's one on each set called From Book to Script. Mm. And they're talking to the writers. They talk to Peter Jackson and I think her name is Philippa.
Philippa yeah. Boyens and right. Fran Walsh.
Yeah, yeah, and they never talk to Fran Walsh. Fran Walsh, I guess, is pretty private.
She is.
She's like the private half of the Peter Jackson team, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Peter Jackson is the public face.
And they are married.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So, but I was really interested to learn about two very close calls. Well, actually three. Three okay. close calls. They said, first of all, one interesting thing was they were constantly editing the script all the way up to the very last day of shooting. And the shoot took like 15 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things was Arwen, like you were talking about. They brought the actress, Liv Tyler. They brought mm-hmm. her in and trained her in sword fighting and everything like that. They were going to make her like the warrior princess of of Middle Earth. You know,
really?
They were. And... they changed their mind. So she got trained, but then I don't think she ever held a sword in the whole movie. Maybe, well, wasn't she holding one in the air, I think?
Maybe at the Ford.
Yes. At that river scene, yeah. Another thing was at the end, both the other two were at the end. One of them is they actually filmed a fight between Aragorn and Sauron. And they decided, and this is what makes me, you know, agree with what Seth said, that, you know, Jackson really did care, mm-hmm. was that they decided that that's not the story, and it weakened Aragorn's stature, I guess.
Oh, good.
Because what he was really doing, and they got this right, what he was really doing was sacrificing in order that Frodo and Sam would have an opening to do what they needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And once they said, okay, that's the right thing to do. They didn't use that. They ended up using, he fought a troll, and some of that footage is him actually fighting Sauron.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then the last thing was Frodo. They were really uncomfortable with, at the very end, with Frodo not doing anything, just being passive. So they actually filmed him shoving Gollum off the cliff.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That
it would have been horrible. And they said that they changed it. They said this was the very last day, the very last day they had the guy who played Gollum, Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
And the second to last day that Frodo, gosh, why don't I recall his name?
Elijah Wood.
The very second to last day that Elijah Wood was going to be in New Zealand. So he said, we're about to lose these two guys. And this is Peter Jackson talking. Mm-hmm. He said, we're about to lose these two guys, but we knew we didn't have it right because every time we looked at it, we couldn't help thinking, well, that was murder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then he said, his exact words were, we lost the theme of forgiveness for Gollum, who was later there to destroy the ring.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah. So I was like, well, hooray, you know, way to go. They spent some time filming, you know, against this green screen, them fighting over the ring. So they still didn't want Frodo not to do anything. But what he did was he went after the ring. And mm-hmm. in going after the ring, they both fall off.
Right.
And that ended up being what they used.
I was even uncomfortable with going that far.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
It was still kind of like Frodo being heroic in a sense, like, oh no, I messed up, which was not.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah.
Not the point.
Right.
I didn't see it that way. I just saw he was like, no, this is mine.
Yeah, and that's what they were going after.
I
saw him giving them direction, and he's like, we're fighting over this ring, and you know, so.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, so it was interesting. So, you know, the other things that they talked about in those features were the arrangement of everything and how they ended the second film, you know, at Helm's Deep, and how the very end of the Two Towers book actually timeline lines up with the events in Return of the King, and you know, how they made those decisions, those kinds of things, you know, and they even showed a chapter list in chronological order. Which was interesting to look at because they were intertwining everything rather than showing, you know, it'd be like a movie for Frodo and Sam and then a movie for, you know, these guys rather than doing it that way. They intertwined all the scenes so that, you know, you were kind of following, especially in the Two Towers, you're following, three stories at the same time, right?
Yeah.
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 And I did notice that, and I thought, well, I understand that you have to change things around for this medium, and I can understand that they were trying to explain everything without having to have a lot of sit-downs for long speeches, because when they were intercutting at the very beginning what happens to Gandalf after he leaves from the party and goes and looks for evidence of the ring, and, you know, and they're... You know, I didn't really like the way the wizards' fights were done. But I was like, really? Well, okay, the teenage boys have to have something. but
that's fun.
Yeah, but and I thought, well, the problem is it's kind of like that thing that I sent you guys yesterday. Is you're not dealing with the imagination anymore. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with a visual art. And this was something that Tolkien wrote in On Fairy Stories. And I was trying to figure out when he actually wrote On Fairy Stories, because I think it was in the 50s or 60s. I can't remember. I think
he had written some of it earlier, and then he revised it later. I just read a biography of him, so shame on me. I should have remembered that, but I don't remember exactly. Well, but I think he revised it. He wrote it and then gave it as a lecture later and revised it.
Okay, because there was a part that I was reading and I was so surprised because I went, oh, this is just what we're talking about, where he's saying he doesn't think that fantasy translates well into other mediums besides literature because you're taking it out of the imagination, which is so powerful, and putting it in a medium that's not really designed to tell it as well. And I thought, oh, how interesting. And then he starts talking about Faerian drama, like meaning of fairies. And I thought, I wonder I know he keeps talking about elves and then going, well, elves are a fantasy too. But I thought, I wonder if he's talking about like TV and movies, because for me that translated into that, where it's more than a play, which is what he was talking about before. And he didn't really totally approve of that.
Yeah, even drama. Yeah, things like Midsummer Night's Dream. And I don't know, did we talk in the Lord of the Rings podcast? Like he read, as a boy, he read Macbeth. And he was really disappointed in Macbeth because he was so excited about, oh, the trees are going to come alive and they're going to march on the castle. And then at the end, it's like, oh, wait, it's just a bunch of guys holding trees. Wait a minute.
Well, then he was talking about the witches in Macbeth. So, see, he's been disappointed on numerous levels. And he said that what he read was able to sustain him through watching the drama of how these witches are always portrayed. And he's always disappointed. They never really work for him. And then when he'll talk about that, people would say, well, you have to think back to the mindset of when Shakespeare wrote it. And he goes, well, now that's taking it out of fantasy and back right into what's understandable in our world. He goes, so that's proving my point. It doesn't do it very well. And so I'm thinking about what we're saying here, which is that, well, to make the stories work, to make the movie sell, to make this understandable, to make this happen, they changed it and changed it and changed it. And I don't get me wrong, I actually like the movies more having watched them now after reading the book than I thought I did. If I hadn't rewatched them. But it's kind of proving Tolkien's point. It's hard to translate things. It's like the book made out of a movie is never as good as the movie that came first, you know, kind of thing. It's hard to translate to those different kinds of storytelling, I think.
Yeah, it's impossible to encompass everything, you know.
Yeah.
Your imagination is kind of endless, right? And this kind of puts a box around it. You know, you're saying,
On the other hand, I was, you know, the great thing about it is that I kept sitting there thinking, I can't believe they sold these movies to everybody. When I think about how many people I know who won't read books because these names don't seem real. and they've probably seen these movies with walking, talking trees and dragons and sorcerers and all this stuff in it. And I thought, well, that's the best shot to get a lot of this story through. And it's a story worth telling.
Yeah, there is that. That's for sure.
So in the end, I forgave it.
Yeah. Yeah. On the good side, this time through, I was really kind of surprised at how much they did get in there. You know, when you think about it, what they could have done, you know, I think that one of the original treatments was two movies and, you know, it would have been, you know, this could have been longer even, you know, add the scouring of the Shire or whatever, which was one, you know, I agree. That was one ending too many in this movie, which seemed to have two really. You know, as far as the pacing of a normal movie goes or an average movie, it felt like, you know, it ended and then it ended again.
Yeah. My husband was like, oh, here we go. The long, slow glances. He goes, they could have cut some of these out.
Oh, that's funny.
I'm like, funny. They love each other. Just leave it alone.
Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. But yeah, I just love all of the sets and the costumes and all that and the music. I love the music. I have the soundtracks. Artistically it's really something.
Well, and they brought some characters alive that I remember when I was reading through the book slowly, as I said, you know, a lot of my mental images for it were coming from the movie, and especially Theoden.
Yeah.
You learn to love him in that movie. And I looked at him with a different eye when I was reading the book, because they really did, I thought, a good job of, well, you know, they had to visually show how he was had been taken hold of instead of the way it's handled in the book. But he comes from weakness into his own strength again.
Yeah, they really had that duality. You know, one of the duality things that we were talking about between him and Denethor, who both lost a son, and, you know, one of them despaired and one of them emerged from despair. You know, the way that we were talking about in the books, you know, the you know, they really are they really have a lot in common, and then they make different decisions.
Yeah. Well, and I wound up going, see, Tom, look, there's this king, and look how this one handles it. And he goes, oh. I was like, I know, that's how I was, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I tried not to do too much of that. Though sometimes he'd be going, I guess that was different in the book. And I was like, I didn't say anything. He goes, you didn't have to. And I went, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Turned into a Lord of the Rings snob.
Oh, that's too funny. That is too funny.
But I loved, like, a lot of the casting was also really good. Some of it I didn't think was quite as good. But Sean Astin, was there ever a more perfect Sam?
Yeah, he did a great job. He really did. And again, you know, he's like the hero of the story. And I think that emerged on them, too, unexpectedly, as they went on and kept editing the things. Like at the end of The Two Towers, they give him this speech, you know, to end the movie with. And, you know, I don't know that was an expected thing, but it was natural. So, but, you know, in the end, I really think that they, Sam did have the prominence that he did in the book.
Yeah.
And Sean Astin, yeah, he really did a good job. One of the things in watching those from book to script things, Viggo Mortensen commented, he said that there were so many copies of Lord of the Rings around. He said they were laying all over the set. He said, you know, actors were reading them and, you know, stagehands were reading them all the time. And he said, even up to the last day, you know, you just see books around. And he thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I know he was really into it. I mean, he was really dying to get that part. And did a lot of the fighting and zone stunts and things.
Yeah, that's cool. And wasn't it cast to someone different? I didn't see this. I thought it was someone different. They started with somebody else, and they immediately realized that this was not going to be okay.
Oh.
And I don't even have any idea who that was, and maybe that's just rumor. And then they brought Viggo in, and it was like, all right, this is it. This will work.
This is the fit.
Yeah. I just don't recall who it was.
Also, I liked a lot of the touches that they added that made it seem... It kind of helped you connect with it outside of the fantasy, like especially once they're in, I guess, the two towers where the lands are being overrun and the woman who's sending her two children off and the people, they'd show every so often the people in the women and children back in Helm's Deep when it's being attacked.
Yeah,
and they did what they could to try to kind of help you go, you know, this could matter to these real people here. You know?
That was good. That was good. Yeah, how did Gollum work for you? Yeah, so I liked how Gollum came out too. I thought it was really good. As a matter of fact, I mean, there are times, especially in Return of the King, where I was looking at that thing, I was just amazed by it. thumbs up, well done. You know?
I know, and I thought it was interesting. Although they were making the connection more than I think it needed to be, but that's, you know, we could argue about that a lot, but. I heard something, I guess I was, because I was listening to Michael Drought, that fantasy class on Rings, Swords, and Monsters.
Right.
Which, thank you very much.
Oh, you bet. And, that's a good course. Really terrific.
Oh, yeah. Well, and he was just going through The Lord of the Rings, and he was saying that they gave Gollum the same eyes as Elijah Wood. So you made that connection. And I went... Oh, you've totally creeped me out. And I still had left to watch the third movie. And luckily, I was like, oh, okay, the way they did it is fine. I was like, oh. But they were just trying to show he was once like Frodo.
Yeah, you know, little touches like that. I mean, that's neat. You know, I never in a million years would have noticed that.
Mm-mm,
and then, you know, the filmmakers did. I mean, that's really cool.
Yeah, well, and it's I thought that Andy Serkis should have gotten some special Oscar.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, he did a great job, and I think maybe Seth brought this up before, is that, you know, he had studied addictive behavior, and it really came across.
Yeah, I did. That's funny. I didn't recall that Seth said that, but there was something that he said, and again, one of these things that I watched, that he used the word addiction, And he, it was when they were refilming the scene, you know, with Frodo going after the ring again. You know, he said it's, you know, it's like two addicts going after the same thing. And yeah, so, I mean, that just files right into what you're saying there. But it's neat that they... It was also surprising to me, but it was also nice that the actors seemed to have a lot of input there. You know, they would they would meet and on their days off, the days off of filming, they, you know, sometimes would go to Jackson's house and they would read through stuff. And they would say, well, this, you know, doesn't work. Wouldn't he do this? You know, and they're all reading the novels at the same time and, you know, trying to come up with, you know, the best way to do things. And they were often listened to.
Well, that's kind of neat.
Yeah, that is kind of cool. It would be, you know, that you know, when you watch these extras, I just, it's almost like living vicariously, because how cool would that have been to be there for 15 months filming Lord of the Rings? Oh, I just can't imagine how cool that would have been. How fun.
And what an immersive experience.
Yeah, just a lot of fun. And all the locations.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, yeah. That first, I think I've seen all the extras on the first set, the Fellowship of the Ring. And then just every now and then I'll watch one. But they were doing, you know, the scouting, you know, they you know, took you along in the helicopters and everything, flying around New Zealand saying, hey, this will work for this. And, hey, I've got a place for that, and let's go look at it, and how fun that would be, too. And then they built these towns. Let's throw together a town for about 10 days, and then, you know, it's just incredible what they go through. It's like, you know, movies, you know, I've learned a lot looking at these extras, you know, just about the movie business and you know, reading this book and how the script comes about. And, you know, movies are like, it's like a business that springs from nowhere and everybody's together for a year and then the business dissolves. I mean, it seems, you know, and then they've got the budget and all this stuff and they've got to figure out, you know, what they're allowed to do within a certain amount of money. And then they let her rip and then everybody disbands. And then they try to get their next job.
Well, you know? And I think that's something that we learned when we watched fairly recently this documentary called Lost in La Mancha. Have you ever seen it?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah, I did. Johnny Depp, Don Quixote, and Terry Gilliam.
Terry Gilliam's movie. Attempt to film, Don Quixote. And that focused a lot on the business side because things weren't coming together. It was like they had the worst luck ever. That's when you discover this is almost like the cursed movie. People keep trying to make it and it just dissolves around them somehow. And Tom was talking about looking at the Lord of the Rings and talking about how what impressed him from Lost in La Mancha was the guy who's got to do the bond for the movie, that if the movie doesn't happen, he's liable for all the costs. And he's like, can you imagine trying to bond out this movie if the first one didn't work? Oh, my gosh. Wow. And some of the stunts they were having people do and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So,
and what an amazing, amazing thing it is that a company okayed three movies at the same time.
Yeah,
they didn't make the first one, and then it did good, and then they made the other two. They said, let's make three movies, agreed to the scripts that were in the state that they were in, and holy cow, for 15 months these guys filmed. And then it was basically 3 years of post-production, 1 year for each movie, back to back.
Right.
Yeah.
And they got so many things right. I mean, yeah, I have problems with a couple of major themes and some small things. But, you know, anything that left me all Sunday and yesterday with the themes of the movie running through my head, the movie themes, musical themes, and then I would kind of flash back on parts of the movie, that's still a powerful experience.
Yeah. Yeah, the music is just terrific in this. Really good. You know, I have all three soundtracks and I've had them for a while. They just hit a home run on all those artistic qualities. I mean, the sheer look of the film, it's great. You know, and like you, when I read the book this time, those are the images that I had, and I didn't feel that they distracted me at all. They were enhancements. Mm-hmm. And the care that they took with all that art as well. They, you know, how many Tolkien calendars have there been? I can't remember what artist it was. Alan somebody?
I don't know.
I don't remember, but he was kind of a famous Tolkien artist. And they actually brought the guy in put him on staff. Yeah, and he was... he contributed all this stuff. You know, he just did a lot of this definitive art around Lord of the Rings long before any movies existed. You know, he's the guy who's, you know, doing all kinds of, you know, they put him on calendars and things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's got books out that are just full of Lord of the Rings art. And they said, okay, this is kind of what we want it to look like, you know? So they bring this guy in rather than just lift it all. They said, let's bring him on. And yeah, they did so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, and speaking of the look, this is something that I remember, again, I was impressed with it, and which is that they let everybody look kind of dirty sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, or they'd shoot scenes and people's hair were blowing in front of their faces and they just let them keep talking, you know, because it's what would have happened.
Right, right.
And I remember when it might have been the first movie came out. There's a Catholic lady who's worked in Hollywood a lot named Barbara Nicolosi. Hmm. And she and I've had a few words sometimes because she also has strong opinions and we don't agree sometimes. And she hated the movies because everybody was so dirty.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, this is your criteria? They're not clean enough? It seems to me like they're having an adventure. Those dirty fingernails mean something out here.
Right, right.
And so I thought, I hadn't really thought about it until then, but I think that's one of the things I liked. It wasn't like some of the 1960s movies where everybody's extremely clean while Christ is being crucified or whatever in the biblical movies and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I was thinking when I saw this battle, you kind of dovetail into this. I haven't seen Braveheart forever. But Braveheart,
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Braveheart was the first movie that I saw one of these battles where everybody's running at each other in lines.
Oh, yeah.
That really stunned me in that I felt like I almost felt a little bit about what it would really have been like.
Mm-hmm.
But Braveheart, you know, everybody was dirty all the way through Braveheart. Except for, you know, every now and then, you know, Gibson and his hair would be all clean.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
Because you had but to, it's funny, the star yeah. has to be seen okay.
Yeah, and that's, you know, parts of the movie-making experience, you know, that I hear just little tidbits about where you have an actor or somebody that, you know, they care very much about their image, and they're worried about, you know, well, if I'm in this movie, are you going to put me in spots where I'll look bad? And
right.
that's like a major consideration, you know, for these guys is, you know, and girls, right? Careers.
Right.
You know,
right.
They're considering that when they, you know, accept parts and all that stuff. But, you know, I could imagine someone in this movie saying, I don't want to be that dirty. And you're like, well, you have to be dirty, you know?
Swamps. Well, yeah. Well, I do. And I do have to say it wasn't always that way because, you know, that's probably got to be the cleanest marsh water I've ever seen after Frodo plunges in and comes out. I'm like, oh, there were a couple specks of dirt on him. But
oh, wow. Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
But yeah. And that's the thing. I have to say, those lines running into battle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Those were so exhilarating. And
yeah, yeah.
It's like you said, you felt the... You have to do it. It's your duty. And the thing where Theoden's running around or, you know, riding, clacking his sword on the lances.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then later Aragorn is, you know, that day may come when men's hearts crumble and they run from the wolves, but it not this day. You know, and you're like, yeah, let's all go together.
Wow.
They did such a great job of conveying that because they had to be heroic. They had to stand. They were the only hope. And it shows you the reasons. I can't remember. I think it might have been Tolkien who said, you know, you fight not because you hate what's in front of you, but because you love what's behind you.
Oh, wow. Well put. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. When I was in Florida, I watched Saving Private Ryan with my dad. What a movie that is. But it opens, it's rough. It's tough to see. It opens with D-Day. And the images, I mean, holy cow. But, you know, I'm just thinking, how on earth do you prepare yourself for D-Day? You know, you're going to, okay, we're going to put you on a boat, and we're going to send you to a beach, and there's going to be a whole bunch of people that don't want you on that beach. And they're going to be shooting at you, and they are ready for us, you know. Mm-hmm. Although the whole thing was a surprise, but the beach was well defended.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, wave after wave of American troops landing on the beach, getting mowed down by machine gun fire. And these guys are somehow doing it, you know. But it's the same. Same kind of thing. Yeah. But, wow, how do you – it's just you know, to sit here and imagine being in one of those lines in, like, Lord of the Rings or Braveheart, or – I mean, this is how – war used to happen, and running out at another army and doing that, and wow. It's like, you know, you've got to be prepared. You're like, I'm going to be dead probably here in just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And well, and there's also the things that get you through, the comradeship, what you're fighting for.
Yeah.
You gotta have all that stuff,
right? Hopefully you're on board with why this is happening in the first place. That would be necessary, I would think.
What, you know, what sent Tolkien into his writing, as we discussed when we talked about the books, is, you know, he was in World War I and only one of his good friends made it out with him alive.
Exactly.
And so he and C.S. Lewis took that route of, we'll find something better and higher to focus on, rather than go into, I don't want to say nihilism, but, you know, what a lot of the other people did who were artistic of, you know, everything's doom and gloom and awful, and realism is, you know, grittiness and horrible reality is the only realism there is.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing higher.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, I did enjoy these movies. I still enjoy them.
Yep.
You know, the books is better is such a cliche, but my gosh, you know. I would recommend anybody who really likes these movies, go ahead and read these books. There's really something else. Add a lot of depth to what you're seeing even on the movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that if you might have to have a guide for the books a little more, as we talked about in the, you know, the books podcast.
That's right, yeah.
But...
yeah, they could listen to our podcast. It's a guide now.
That's
right. Let that lead them to other things, you know.
That's right. A very slight guide, because I'm still finding stuff, because I was thinking of that, you know, the Michael Drought thing. There are podcasts. Well, that's a class, but he's obviously heavily focused on Tolkien. I remember seeing on Audible, they were saying, this guy, all he does is talk about Tolkien in here. Well, because what he did formed the way everybody treated fantasy from then on. And what's kind of interesting is that he still was doing it in little bits and pieces. And when I was listening to Michael C. Drought, he was talking about the fact that, well, at one time Treebeard was going to be evil. And it's almost like listening to you talk about Peter Jackson and how did they come to this stuff, you know, and he was going to capture the hobbits and no, then he changed how he was going to be. And I'm not one who really cares about what led up to stuff, but in that sense, it's interesting in building something huge.
Yeah, I think, you know, I do like hearing about some of those decisions often. I can imagine that Peter Jackson, well, probably Tolkien too, probably never felt finished. You know, it's like you reach a point where, okay, I'm told I have to be done. You know, because, you know, Peter Jackson, you know, he's running this business, right? And this is the end. I've got to send this out into the world now. But I'm sure that there are things. Well, Lucas, as an example, Lucas kept fiddling. You know, I don't expect Peter Jackson to fiddle, but, you know, George Lucas is like, man, I wish I could fix that, you know, because I couldn't do it the way I wanted to do it. And that bothers me, you know, and he sure did catch a lot of flack for it, but, you know, I didn't mind it. you know, well, I enjoyed watching some of those. Yeah.
Well, and also when you say they keep fiddling or what, you know, it's goes back to that story that we mentioned before, Leaf by Niggle.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, the it is an allegory, and the character's name is Niggle. He keeps niggling. He keeps adding little bits to his big painting, a leaf here, a little bit there. And when he's called for his great journey and he has to leave and he can't take anything with him, he was still thinking about, oh, I know how to fix that corner now.
Hmm.
I think if you're engaged in it, it's always that way. You're always, you know, kind of like you're describing Peter Jackson. It's not right. We have to get this part right. You know, so you have to let some of the littler stuff go. And I can say, have a bit of a softer feel to him now that you guys have told me all that. But still, I think there are some big things where they could have worked in Arwen and Aragorn as a bigger theme, which I understand you have to have a few things like that for people to latch onto.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they could have worked it in without sacrificing a few of the bigger points.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. And how it changed Aragorn.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, you know, Aragorn and Frodo are both, you know, sort of in a fundamental way changed.
And they're both weakened. And,
yeah, they're both weakened, right.
Yeah, they're both wimpier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they were going around, either one of them, striding, but they were just more self-confident of who they were as people, I think. And I heard somebody, and it may have been the Tolkien professor, talking about the fact that it was almost as if they felt you couldn't relate to a hero unless he started off like you and me. And we saw him become something bigger. And that is Frodo's function. And it is Merry and Pippin's function, especially, which did annoy me about the movies. They stayed young seeming and very stupid a lot longer than I felt they should have. But they kind of take you on that maturation process of finding out more of who you are because you're being tested by all this stuff. But Aragorn, he was 500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He'd done that already. And, you know, and Faramir, how his character was fundamentally changed. And I think they could have still told that story, making the point about Denethor, but without having him be such, you know, a wuss.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I just think, I understand that you fight various battles, but some of those battles you have to fight are just with who those characters are.
What do you think about Denethor's attitude towards Eomer? Oh, I'm sorry, Theoden's attitude towards Eomer. Is there a parallel between?
Good,
I'm sorry.
I was like, did they ever even meet?
Did they ever meet? Yeah, yeah. Theoden. You know, I'm thinking about the parallels between Theoden and Denethor, and you know, Denethor clearly was not fond of Faramir, but I didn't sense a whole lot between Theoden and Eomer, but I didn't really sense any animosity either, and I don't recall in the book they got along just fine, didn't they?
Well, yeah, in the book he was his heir.
Right. I mean, but.
And he was like, yes, and you're my strong right arm kind of thing.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
And because he treated Eowyn in the same way, just, you know, when he said, you have to help get the people to safety or whatever it was. And she's like, well, don't send me off in the book, I'm saying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's like, you're acting like this is something bad. This is, they said, the people of my house, and they reminded me of you, and I knew you could handle this. This is something I would have a man do, okay? And,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but he treated Eomer like an heir, and they didn't have, right, his son wasn't even in the book, his son's death, just that he was dead.
Right, so they both lost their eldest son, right, or their favorite, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I just wondering if the parallel extended to their feelings about their living sons, but I just don't recall much between Theoden and Eomer either way.
Yeah.
Other than he was sent away when, you know, Theoden was taken over, you know, he sent Eomer away.
Right.
But you know, that was not Theoden doing that. That was
Well, and I guess that was kind of the sign that he would have kept him close to him otherwise. And I think in the book it was a little more played up that they were you know, oh, here you are.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I was wondering where you were, kind of thing.
Gotcha.
As opposed to in the, you know, Denethor just controlling everything with a tight fist in the book, where Faramir was the one who had the dream of why he should go to seek everybody at Rivendell.
Mm-hmm.
Boromir, I'm sorry, I'm starting to struggle with all these names. Boromir has it once, and Denethor goes, you better go. Whereas if he had sent Faramir, who was, you know, completely different than in the movie, and, you know, grounded in himself and knew what was right, everything would have been completely different. And I guess, and I can't remember if we talked about that in the book podcast, but that's one more example of, well, you made the wrong choice again. Okay, I can work with this, says luck and chance and whatever you want to call that overriding power. But it's going to cost you, because I can't fix it otherwise.
Wow. Yeah, that's just neat. You know, mm-hmm. I like that about Tolkien. That's one of the things I love about the book.
Yeah, and I don't think you got that sense in the movie, although I'm not sure how you would have done it, because you would have had to have somebody continually going, oh, this and this and this and this. And I do think there were chances in a variety of situations for those little toss-off lines that could have emphasized things that mattered like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have had to be something where I can imagine that there's so much else going on that you're just like, I can't worry about that right now.
You bet. Cool.
So I'm going to cut him some slack on that.
Sounds good. Well, good. Yeah. For those of you wondering where Seth went, I'm afraid he had to go. So,
well, we're glad he could be here for a little
while. Yeah, I'm really glad he was here for the time we had him. So,
yeah.
Yep. So thanks, Seth. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
And, all right, so what do we have coming up on A Good Story Is Hard to Find?
What do we have coming up?
Next up is Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman.
That's right. I just finished listening to that.
Oh, good.
Yep. I haven't reread that in so long, and I've read that a number of times. That was so good. That'll be fun.
Fantastic. Just wondering, at one time, I heard that was going to be a movie. And I'm just looking up Good Omens on IMDb.
That's one I would really cringe over, worrying they did it right.
Apparently, it's in development. There's no details other than it exists as a project. So
that could never
cringeworthy,
happen again.
Cringeworthy, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then after that, we're going to have a movie called Shower, which is a Chinese film, you said.
That's right. It is a Chinese film about a family in Beijing.
Cool. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And then after that, we'll do The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion.
I don't know how you say that. Simsion is how I've been saying it. Yes.
Well, good.
Something completely, both the movie and the book are going to be non-fantasy, non-etc.
Well, sounds good to me.
Yeah, something different.
Yeah, and then we're going to do a religious book on May the 15th. Jesus, A Pilgrimage by James Martin.
Yep.
Looking forward to that. I have my book right here. Very happy. Yep. Can't wait.
Somehow that one surprised me. It grabbed me, and I'll probably have to be going back through it because I read it really fast.
Oh, good. Okay.
Meaning it was good.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I can't wait. I'm going to be diving into that one soon.
Yeah,
good omens for this week, and then maybe that next.
Yeah, that one doesn't come out until April, I think. So we're going to be on the advance cusp of talking about that book.
Oh, good. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for listening, everybody.
Yes,
and
thank
listening
you.
To
and
our
thank you for
Lord
making me watch
stuff.
The movies again, Scott. I probably wouldn't have grabbed them out for a really long time.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
I'll probably enjoy some more of these extras.
I'm always the person who didn't want to watch the extras. Mm-hmm. I remember after the first Indiana Jones movie came out, my husband's watching the thing about how he went under the car with his whip. And I was like, what? You just took all the magic away.
All the magic is gone.
It was gone. In that particular scene. And that's when he went, oh, fine.
Yeah. I just love behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
I really do. I just, you know, I like showing up places early while they're setting up. I would enjoy that. It's like setting up for a play. That's me. I'm going to be there watching them do that.
Yep. You and my husband.
I love it. Good deal. All right. Well, thanks again, everybody. See you in a couple weeks.
Yep. See ya.
Bye-bye. Bye.